Welcome back to Small Town Missing. I'm Thomas.
I'm Will.
And I'm Rhonda.
And thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you so much for sharing and subscribing and just thank you.
Always.
Yeah. It's fun to do this. I'm enjoying it. I hope y'all are too.
Yeah, I've been really enjoying it. I said we didn't do this last week, did we, Thomas?
No, I was on vacation, but we did have an episode release.
We did. The H.H. Holmes.
Yes, we had a leftover from RTW, and we just reused it.
Yep.
And that way, we did have something. It wasn't our usual content, but it was something. We didn't want to just completely abandon everybody.
I know. I said, well, I'm glad you took a vacation. Did you have fun? That's the important
thing. I did.
I
had a lot of fun.
Good. I'm glad.
Enjoyed myself.
And I wanted to say, too, we've heard, I was going to read this one. So, we had set up. We don't have it, so don't get excited, everybody. We don't have one that's officially set up right now. But originally, a few months ago, whenever we were first starting on Small Town Missing, I was going to do a Facebook page, and I started doing it and linked it to my original Facebook page, whatever, and didn't think I really published it or anything. Well, we got a comment on it, apparently, so I guess I did publish it. But I'll leave, just the first name is Paula. I'll just say Paula. So thank you, Paula, for leaving a review and a post on it. She just said, I previously left a review hoping you would get a Facebook page and some recommendations for cases. I actually edited my review weeks ago to add that I wanted you to cover the Angela Hammond case. I did see that, Paula, so that is coming, I promise. But thank you so, so much for reaching out.
Yeah, I have to say, everybody, please be patient because you know, the three of us are busy. Obviously, this is not a full time job for us.
So
we wish it was.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. But we do have our full time jobs, and none of us exactly have a big social media presence. So I'm sorry if sometimes we lag on checking some things, and we'll try to do better at that.
We're not good at that.
Rhonda's secret million followers that she has hidden away somewhere.
I wish.
But I did say before we get started that, well, I guess two things before we get started. We do have a Gmail account that I have created just for Small Town Missing. We'll start including that in the show notes. It's all one word, smalltownmissing@gmail.com. So we'll have that at just posted in the end.
Yes.
And so Thomas made sure he would. And then the other thing, the case that we're covering today, Rhonda, you probably remember it. We did a little bit on it on our RTW's Wild History Ride podcast. I went to paranormal experience years ago called the Gribble House.
Oh man.
And I remember we had that on our ghost episode. You remember that, Thomas?
Yes, ghost stories. I do remember that.
That was a good one.
I also remember whenever you came back home from that trip.
Yes.
And you still had the scratches on your back.
I did have the scratches. I'm telling y'all, it's a good story. If y'all want to go listen to the ghost stories episode on RTW that kind of details a little bit of what happened. But the case that we're doing today is based on that case. So there you go.
Awesome. So you guys ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Well, as Will said, this is a throwback to our other podcast, RTW's Wild History Ride. And it's been almost 2 years ago.
Yeah, I think you're right.
It's been a while, and the case is still unsolved.
Yeah, well, I guess I should have rephrased it. I think technically they think they know who did it, but it's not definitively solved. So maybe, you know, it's one of those things they think they got the guy, but they don't know. So it's kind of mysterious.
Well, I do have questions as we go through this.
Okay.
So, but I'll hold them to the end because I know I mentioned that whenever you send me down another path and I'm trying to do one of my scripts.
Yes.
That I get sidetracked. So,
me too, Rhonda.
I won't do that to anybody else. So the case revolves around an unsolved triple axe murder.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty gruesome.
That is very gruesome.
And it occurred in Savannah, Georgia, on December 9th, 1909.
I would go as far as to say our oldest case, or maybe not the oldest. I guess the Flannan mystery was older, maybe. I think it might have been at the turn of the century.
Yeah, that might have been 1899, something like that.
Yeah,
it
I
was
think
close.
You're right.
Wasn't there a serial killer in New Orleans, the Axeman?
I don't know. Is there?
I don't recall that.
You know something about this that I don't?
I'm surprised.
I thought there was. I thought it was something like.
Well, now we're talking about Savannah, Georgia.
Yeah, I know, but that's why I was wondering if there was a connection.
I don't know, maybe.
Y'all continue. I'm going to do some research.
Oh, wow. That would be interesting if we solved
this 1909 case.
And as I said, it's unsolved, or they may have had the person, which that's going to be a lot of my questions whenever we get to the end about how they came up with who did this.
I have no, Rhonda, honestly, I have no idea. This is crazy police work if I've ever seen.
Yeah, no kidding. But even today, you can take a tour of the location where the crime supposedly occurred, and there are ghosts, as Will said, there are ghost hunting tours in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And the house no longer stands, but it's on, I believe you said it was a fire station.
Yeah, I think it's like maybe like an unused fire station. Like they still have like the layout of the building, but I don't think it's a functioning fire station.
Okay, gotcha. And it's interesting. I mean, Savannah is like one of the most haunted cities in the U.S.
Oh, 100%. Very interesting tour, too, if you ever get a chance to take it.
Okay. According to an article from SavannahNow.com by Linda Sickler, an unidentified man was passing by the house at 401 West Perry Street when he heard groans coming from a partially opened front door.
No, gosh.
That's kind of creepy.
That is creepy.
The home itself was described as a wooden house with dirty windows, mm-hmm. which, wow, that's just... I just see so many different images whenever you mention that.
They were descriptive. That's mentioned. They were very descriptive.
Now, the unidentified man went up to check on the source of the sounds, and he found at the front door a body.
Yeah.
And the body was actually blocking the front door.
Mm-hmm.
The body was that of Maggie Hunter. She was 35 years old and a resident of the house. Maggie was still alive, but lying in a pool of her own blood.
Yeah.
She had suffered extensive injuries so that her skull had been crushed.
Oh my gosh. I can only imagine. That's like, and especially for 1909, like that's a very gruesome scene.
It is. And of course, the passerby was terrified, ran to a nearby drugstore and informed the authorities and to get an ambulance.
Yeah, of course. Like, I'm glad he did that. At least he had, like, the forethought, too. Like, hey, like, time is of the essence here.
After the police arrived at the scene, they discovered two more bodies. And those bodies were of Carrie Olander and Eliza Gribble.
Yeah,
and
which is the house is named after.
Both women had similar injuries in comparison to Maggie. Carrie was found down one of the hallways, and the position of her body indicated that she had been outraged by her attacker mm-hmm. before her throat was slashed. Eliza was found in one of the back bedrooms of the house.
Yeah.
Now, outraged, sexually assaulted, I assume.
So, I don't know, actually, Rhonda. I tried to, like, research what that meant. I don't know if that means that, like, maybe, you know, although later things just say that there wasn't really anything disturbed. I honestly couldn't find a definitive definition of what that means. Maybe it was different at the time. Maybe it's, like, a different meaning then as to what we think of now. So, I have no idea on that, honestly.
Yeah, my thought was sexually assaulted.
Yeah, which is possible, I'm sure.
I would guess mm-hmm. possible. But why just Carrie? Why not the other two women?
Yeah. And like it's weird. You'll kind of find out some more details of, like, I think Eliza's body at the time. Yeah, so it's like a very odd placement, I feel like.
All right. Now, the crime itself occurred fairly early in the day. Early enough that the crime was reported in the evening newspaper.
Yeah, it was the evening newspaper. You're right.
Reporters at the time were even allowed to roam the crime scene.
Oh my God.
And report on what they witnessed. Oh my gosh.
Well, and you know, I think the article went into a lot of detail too. It's like, you know, there were there were opposing newspapers at the time, which I'm sure were like, well, we got to get the first break on this and we got to do this. I'm sure they were just fueling this case. Like, what did I say in the one of our episodes? I said like U.S. Weekly or something like that for the time.
Yeah, apparently there was a lot of detail. And as in particular into the aspects of Eliza's body, saying that it appeared that she had been struck on the head while reading.
Yeah. So like, yeah, just like kind of in her own home reading, like something that someone essentially attacked her from behind.
Unfortunately, many papers surmised that it was an unidentified African-American man or men that were responsible for the crime. Upwards of 150 black men were being held in Savannah as possible suspects.
Wow.
And why? I have no idea.
Yeah, we don't know.
Yeah, no idea. It doesn't appear to be any physical evidence that could be found. So it's why? Again, why 150 black men?
Yeah.
And how did they pinpoint the particular person?
Yeah, I guess just unfortunately a sign of the times, you know, which I mean, what can you say about that? It's just really unfortunate.
I would agree. A sign of the times. Mm-hmm. That was what the conclusion they jumped to.
Yep.
The town was in such an uproar over the crime that riots broke out, leading to windows being broken, fences being pulled down in an attempt to uncover a suspect. Now, were they trying to breach the jail, or do you know?
I don't know. All it said was just that there was like just an uproar. So I don't, why are they destroying all the homes if they're, you know, looking for a particular person? I don't know. They do. I think I go into a little bit later about they had an idea of who this person was. But I don't know why you destroy anybody else's stuff for just that one person. So no good rhyme or reason.
According to an article in the Evening Press on December 9th, 1909, so that evening,
yeah,
the crime was apparently committed by a man who'd been formerly employed as a cook in a local restaurant in the area. He was roughly 26 to 27 years old, 5'8", and the perpetrator was believed to have been wearing a gray sweater trimmed in red.
Mm-hmm.
Bloodhounds were taken to the scene of the crime as well, but could find no scent to trace.
Yeah.
Ultimately, a $1,000 reward was posted for the arrest of the unknown suspect.
Yeah, that's a lot of money for 1909.
Yeah, well, that's pretty specific. So you had 150 black men being held as possible suspects.
Yeah.
And then you come up with a man who's 26, 27 years old, 5'8", and was wearing a gray sweater trimmed in red.
Yeah, I think, and like we said too, I think that the person they thought who was the perpetrator, the one they were describing, was a black man. So I guess, you know, they just didn't have any other very specific things to look out for. That's very generalized. Like, you know, I feel like just clothes and stuff like that. Like, I feel like a whole bunch of people probably had clothes like that. So I don't know. I mean, it sounds like they had their work cut out for them, but it was very overgeneralized.
All right. Well, by the next Monday, a search was conducted by lamplight, and police uncovered some burned cloth and bloodstains. And but beyond that, little else was discovered.
Yeah.
Okay. Now we're going into some detail on the victims.
Mm-hmm.
Eliza Gribble was originally a native of Cornwall, England, and she had come to Savannah and settled before the Civil War had started. She and her daughter, Carrie, who was also one of the other victims,
yeah,
had rented the house just a short time before the murders.
Yeah, which is so unfortunate. I'm like, oh my gosh, like, just imagine, like, if they wouldn't have picked that house, what would have happened?
Eventually, they subleased a room to Maggie Hunter, who was the woman who was found at the front door, mm-hmm, on December 9th.
Still alive.
Eliza was described as partially crippled, and her daughter, Carrie, was partially deaf as well.
Mm-hmm.
All right, could that have been... Could they have been killed because of that?
Yeah. I think I had seen other speculation at the time too, Rhonda. That's a good point. That maybe it's appeared later that there wasn't a lot of things disturbed in the rooms because maybe Eliza didn't hear it. Maybe Carrie didn't hear it. You know, something like that. Like, they have these physical ailments and stuff that they're kind of dealing with that, you know, maybe could, that maybe that's why that nothing was really disturbed.
Yeah. And let me back up. I said maybe that's why they were killed. Maybe that's why the house was broken into. Because of their disability. Yeah, maybe Eliza couldn't get around. Carrie couldn't have heard someone who broke into the home.
Yeah.
That's just my thought.
Yeah, easy to do.
The house they had chosen had been fashionable during the 19th century, but was in serious decline by the turn of the 20th.
Yeah.
So much so that it had been turned into a boarding house by the time the crimes had taken place.
Yeah, and it we already discussed, it's like kind of dilapidated looking, like dirty windows, stuff like that. So not upkept very well.
Yeah. Weirdly enough, Maggie Hunter had moved into the home just one day before she was attacked.
Wow.
She was a native of Bullock County, which is in Georgia.
Yeah.
And recently separated from her third husband, J.C. Hunter. J.C. was 30 years older than Maggie, and he even referred to her as his daughter.
Ew.
And yeah, I know, that is kind of gross.
That's kind of weird.
And she referred to him as the old man.
Yeah, so it sounds as if, you know, I think from other things I've gathered, it's that Maggie was really trying to, like, set out on her own and to, like, get her own money, I'm sure, which was hard for a woman of that time. And I think she was trying to find work as, like, a seamstress, essentially.
Two main theories existed during the time, according to some of the townsfolks. One saw the main motive as a crime for the crime as robbery.
Yeah.
I could see. Eliza apparently had a trunk that held some very valuable objects. So essentially, the women were murdered, so not to leave any witnesses.
Yeah.
But it says nothing was disturbed.
Yeah, and I don't know what was taken. Like, how would they know? I'm assuming maybe. I don't know if they looked through. I mean, how could you actually determine what she had in there, too, if it was, like, of hers? Like, she would only know, potentially, I guess, what was in that trunk. And I guess any other person who knew was dead. So, I don't know. How do we know if, like, anything was truly disturbed in that regard?
Yeah. She may have had family members that said, look, I know she
has this.
She has this, but who knows if they were down on their luck. Maybe she had sold that stuff.
True. I mean, they're not living in the best area, it sounds like.
Wow. We're doing a lot of speculating.
Yeah, true.
The other theory saw JC murdering his ex-wife, Maggie. Unfortunately for Eliza and Carrie, they were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
Despite both theories being plausible, no one had heard or seen anything during those early hours on December 9th. The house even sat directly across from the Citizens and Southern Bank branch building. 175 employees of the bank heard nothing on the day of the murders.
Yeah, which, I mean, granted, if they're thinking, because I know Eliza was, like, reading when she was attacked, assumingly, maybe they didn't have time to scream out. Maybe, you know, Carrie didn't have time to scream out, so maybe that's why they didn't hear anything. But that's speculation as well. We don't know.
Well, and also, apparently, there was a lot of foot traffic in the area.
Yeah, the article was really like, oh, yeah, you have, it's like lunchtime in this area. I think it was around before 3 that the bodies were discovered, so that was like prime. I think they said dinner time for that area, kind of, which is an early dinner. But people would have been in that area kind of going back and forth.
Yeah, as I said, the rooms had no sign of a struggle in them. Some fingerprints were found in a thick layer of dust on one of the doors separating the front and the back halls, but officials couldn't do anything with them at the time.
Mm-hmm.
One deputy sheriff found a bloody iron bar that was believed to have been a piece of piping, and it was hidden in the woodshed at the back of the lot.
Yeah, I never really heard much about that elsewhere, though. Like, I don't know if they do anything with that information.
Authorities believe that the murderer had killed each woman one at a time or had another accomplice help him commit the crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Eliza and Carrie were eventually laid to rest at Laurel Grove Cemetery on December 11th. They were exhumed for post-mortem test a few days later. Maggie, the only surviving victim of the crime at the time, lived for 3 days after the attack. She initially improved but quickly worsened.
Yeah.
A local reverend named John S. Wilder went to Maggie's bedside to ask her questions shortly before her death.
Yeah.
All right, so... And I said I was going to hold my questions.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. Why didn't police officers ask her these questions?
I don't know. I think maybe they were trying to do... She was very... So I will say this. Maggie was extremely delirious at that time. So much so that, like, you know, they had been prescribing her opiates, which can cause delusions and confusion, which we've talked about in other podcasts before, like Lizzie Borden. But... I guess in conjunction with that, she was also delirious because I'm sure her blood pressure was low. I'm sure she was getting septic, like all this kind of stuff. But they had even taken her veins and tried to instill, you know, I guess like a old IV type of situation, like a little quart of saline. And it just was not working. So she was very delirious at the time. I'm assuming they used him in order because she knew who he was. He was like a very prominent reverend in the area.
After asking Maggie who had assaulted her, she apparently said it had been a white man and called a name out. The reverend never disclosed the name Maggie gave, but we're assuming she called out JC's name because he was eventually arrested.
Yeah.
To save himself from conviction, JC eventually stated that he had been at the house because he was bringing Maggie a sewing machine so she could make money for herself.
Yeah, good on her. She's a divorced woman. She needs some kind of income.
Yeah, and that was thoughtful of him.
Yeah, that was very thoughtful.
On the morning of the murders, he had apparently only visited Maggie to see that she was satisfied with the machine, but authorities revealed that was a lie.
You know, and I looked into that. I don't know why they thought that was a lie. I know that there was a couple of witnesses saying that they saw a man matching his description, kind of pacing in front of the home. And also, I know that I think some of his coworkers, eventually, they tried to exonerate him in this regard. But I think they only said that he was only gone from like 12 to 12:30, which would have, if he's back by 12:30 and the women were supposedly dead by 3, maybe they're like, okay, well, he didn't do it then. But I don't know. They just, some witness put him there, like they thought a man matching his description had done it.
All right, well, they eventually put together a timeline, and it saw Maggie returning to the home shortly after Carrie and Eliza had been murdered.
Yeah.
It was believed that Maggie had returned to the house to use her sewing machine because it had scraps of lining and was threaded and fitted with a new needle.
Yeah, that sounds like, I mean, listen, I said, you know, she was working, and then maybe something disrupted her.
They believe Maggie had been startled by a noise and ventured out of her room, and had met her attacker.
Yeah, so unfortunate.
JC was the most likely suspect, according to the police. JC had been sent to prison twice, once because of horse thievery.
I know, what a time. Horse thievery.
And once for bigamy. Yeah. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
So that was her third husband.
Yeah.
I wonder what wife number wife she was.
I know. That's my thing, too. It sounds like, you know, I don't know. It sounds like there's a lot going on in that relationship.
Police searched his home at the corner of Montgomery and Congress Streets and supposedly uncovered a package of clothing stained with a substance similar to blood.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like they had Luminol and stuff back then, so I don't know how you would necessarily test that.
I don't either. One witness stated that JC even threatened to kill Maggie several different times.
Not a good look, I'm telling you.
JC even knew the interior of the house because he had repapered the interior 6 years before the murders.
Yeah, so he would have known like where maybe certain, like the trunk was, like maybe where Eliza's bedroom was. You know, he would know the interior very well.
A walking cane was discovered at the scene that had apparently been gifted to JC as well. This claim was supported by Maggie Hunter's brother.
Yeah, so I mean, really putting him at the scene. I mean, why would that cane be there otherwise, especially since they were divorced?
Although this seems pretty cut and dry, many other authorities don't see a white man committing these crimes.
It sounds so cut and dry to me.
Which was unfortunately a common theme at the time. I know, Thomas, I see this look of disbelief on your face.
No, I just think people are stupid.
I do too. I'm like, I don't know, y'all. Like, I mean, I get it, like, whatever, the signs of the times, but you can't really disregard any of that other information. I guess I do, you know what? I take it back. The physical evidence was there, it seems like, you know, like the cane, the other stuff. But, you know, I don't know. I don't know why they had such a vendetta here, it sounds like.
I don't know. On January 25th, 1910, a man named Bingham Bryan, the yard man of the murder home, was arrested and was thought to have killed the women to steal Eliza's property.
I don't get that at all.
After some interesting tactics by the police, which included setting up essentially a haunted experience at the Gribble house, Brian was declared insane and was no longer considered a suspect.
Why was he declared insane for y'all setting up this weird experience?
Okay, there's got to be a book out or something that has more detail than some of this, because declared insane.
Yeah, so I can look that up for you, Rhonda, in a little bit if you want to continue going, and I'll kind of give you some details from the article that once I find it.
No, I'll tell you what the insane part is.
Yeah.
Is setting up a haunted house to take a possible suspect through. That's what's insane.
Essentially, the Reader's Digest version, I think, is that they basically took like wax figures and mounted them in similar locations to how the bodies were found, and then like kind of turned out the lights, like had a lamplight kind of were going through, and the men were like, "You see, these were the women you killed," and like just showing the body. And he's like, "I didn't." He like did not even show. He's like, "I did not kill these women." Like he was like just like flat affect, I think, like all the same. Like he did not kill them, you know. So it's so weird. I don't get that whole charade there.
Yeah, like I said, the police tactic was what was insane.
Yep.
Eventually, a grand jury indicted J.C. Hunter, William Walls, a family friend who went to see Maggie Hunter on the day of the murders, and a new suspect named John Coker.
Yeah, I believe Coker's right. I think that's right.
All three denied killing the women. Well, of course.
Of course they would.
Walls and Coker were never taken to trial, but J.C. Hunter was convicted August 17th, 1910, and sentenced to death by hanging. Mm-hmm, okay. Mm-hmm. In another weird turn, J.C. Hunter was baptized on the day of his execution, and his sentence was commuted by the governor of Georgia that very same day. Okay,
And people wonder why the South is looked down on.
I know. I'm like, y'all, like, why? Like, it's so weird. Well,
it's stupid like this.
All right, we're gonna have to cut a disclaimer.
What time was that? It was, I just said the bad word.
Always.
I'll look for it. I know what time it was. But it's stupid crap like that people did that makes us look like idiots.
Well,
to this day.
I don't know. I mean, and granted, I got it that everything is in its infancy. Like, you know, forensics really isn't a thing yet. Like, you don't have the technology to, like, it's really just good old fashioned police work at this time that would see these women like getting justice, but it just doesn't sound as if justice was done for the women at all.
To this very day, we don't know who definitively killed the three women at the Gribble house, and the story continues to enthrall many who hear the tale. If anyone is ever in Savannah, you can call the Gribble house paranoia if any of you are ever in Savannah, you can call the Gribble house paranormal experience to book a ghost tour in the same area where the three bodies were discovered.
Yeah.
Okay.
Rhonda, are you going to call right now?
No, I'm not going to call right now. I really not, because I was just in Savannah back just earlier this year.
Yeah.
And I probably should have gone by, but I didn't.
As far as I know, it's still functioning. It had an open and a closed time when I Googled it, so I'm assuming it's still going.
All right, there's just so much here. Okay, I mean, obviously, we didn't have DNA to check if that was really bloodied clothing.
I want the fingerprint. That's what I want.
And that's what I was going to say next. I mean, they couldn't have done anything with the fingerprint, because what would they have compared it to?
Yeah, CODIS wasn't a thing back then.
No, oh my gosh.
Unless they would have taken, I mean, I'm assuming, I need to see when fingerprinting was really started being prevalent in police work. But, I mean, I'm assuming you could have taken fingerprints and compared them just like by eye to eye. But I don't know. I mean, maybe.
Well, you know, didn't we do something about that on one of the old RTWs?
I feel like we did.
It was like, I want to say New York, early 1900s, that someone actually started, or maybe it was even in London, someone actually started developing a card system of fingerprints.
I think you're right. I do think I remember. Was that like, that wasn't H.H. Holmes' time, was it? Like, no, I forgot when H.H. Holmes was, honestly, off the top of my head. But yeah, I think you're right. That does sound very familiar.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it was, you know, obviously policing type research, or however you want to put it, was in its infancy back then. But I think they were starting to evolve into something that's where you might actually have some luck capturing someone.
Yeah, like capturing somebody. I mean, unless you caught someone just red-handed, which it seems like, you know, they would have had to do a lot of the times.
Well, I'm not too sure. I think they were pretty darn close with some of these people, and they just didn't seem to want to do anything about it.
Yeah, to me, I think JC is the most obvious person, just because we know the most about him and everything. It was presented to us at the experience that they never truly did have a guy who they, you know, definitively thought did it, but I think everyone is under the assumption that JC did it. But I mean, other than that, if it is a random person, that is some very heinous crimes that you're performing just on these random women, which, I mean, I guess we've seen crazier, but you know, that is very unfortunate.
Yeah, and I'm probably being too harsh on early 1900s policing, but they sublease a room to Maggie. Like, what would they say?
The day before, and she moves in, and then the next day.
Yeah, they're dead.
Yeah.
Basically.
So that to me
she dies eventually.
That's very interesting. If that's a coincidence, gosh, I don't know. I don't think that's a coincidence.
And then the cane in the house?
Yeah.
I mean, I could say maybe because one of the women was partially paralyzed.
Yeah.
Eliza. Mm-hmm. So maybe Maggie said, you know what? I've got a cane I'm not using. It happens to belong to my husband. He doesn't need it.
Yeah.
I'll let you have it.
True. I could see that.
I could see that. So there are some things that maybe, you know, you could justify some of these things.
It's like Lizzie Borden. We'll never know. We'll never know.
No, but this is just, wow. I mean, in today's time, you would think this would be resolved within a week.
Oh, yeah. It sounds like it wasn't, you know, especially with a fingerprint. Like, that's something very definitive. And granted, I guess that could have been one of the women's fingerprints, but I'm not sure if they ever compared anything. But, you know, who knows? I mean, a very, very interesting story for sure.
And why didn't the Reverend ever disclose the name that Maggie gave him?
I don't know. To me, I don't know if that's like, you know, it's between me, you, and God. I don't know if that's like just what it was, but who knows? He never did. So I think everyone was just under the assumption that it was him. Like, I think she had another thing that she said in her delirium that, oh yeah, JC slapped me, and you know, stuff like that. So she had said that in there as well. So I don't know, but she's also delirious. Like, you can't, no offense to her, you can't really take anything she says seriously in that regard, because you don't know what she's experiencing on the inside. Because I mean, apparently from everybody, like, she was very delirious, so you're not going to get any really formed thoughts there.
That's true. I mean, she was in bad shape. Her skull was crushed.
Yeah,
Lord knows what they were shooting her up with.
Yeah, opiates. They did say opiates. A lot of opiates.
Yeah, a lot of opiates could have been what killed her.
Yeah, true.
All
That's
right.
another story.
That is another story. We should do a story on 1900s medicine.
That would be interesting.
Oh my God.
That would be interesting. Maybe that'll be a follow-up on some of these other cases and stuff, like the first case with fingerprinting or something like that.
Maybe. Maybe we could do something like first or, yep, you know, milestones.
Y'all
that
let
kind
us
of
know.
Thing.
Y'all email smalltownmissing@gmail.com and we'll let us know.
I do know an episode that Will would like to do.
What?
The Axeman of New Orleans.
Oh, is that one? Did you look
found
it?
Oh, it was a real thing. Yeah, I'll tell you all about it later.
What year?
We're not going to talk about it. I'll tell you all about it later.
Okay.
Oh,
okay.
Well, you know, if it's a murder, Will's all
over
it.
Oh, I'm all over definitely. It. This one was a big thing for me.
Again.
Yeah, I have to remind you sometimes that this title is Small Town Missing.
Missing people.
I lived this, y'all.
Well, I
was
technically speaking, killer might be missing.
True. Well, the thing is,
that's a big stretch.
Y'all,
the
reason this was such an important case for me, I stood in the exact spots where their bodies were, and they had them outlined and everything.
And he was literally walking around, and something scratched him through a incredibly thick jacket.
It was probably Eliza. She's like, listen, you could solve this thing. Come on. Like,
help me.
Yeah. Like, yeah, bless your heart.
That's disturbing even more.
Yeah, I'm not sure I ever want to do that if I go back to Savannah again.
My reviews.
It was interesting for sure.
I don't do ghosts.
Oh, hey, you had a ghost experience at my house. That's another episode.
I've had a couple, but.
Oh, no, I was just going to do the same thing that you're probably going to say. I was going to say that, you know, our sources, as always, are going to be listed in our show notes. And you can follow us on Instagram at Small Town Missing. And we'll have another episode next week. And Thomas, I guess you're probably going to talk about the Gmail account again.
Oh, that's all I was going to say, was that we are also adding the Gmail. And if you have any suggestions, please send it to us through there. We'll be checking. That's his
role.
Yeah,
that's my job.
That's his job. And thank you guys so much for listening. I'm sorry my voice is a little crappy. I was sick over the weekend. I had a cold, and I am recovering. So please be a little patient with my crappy voice. But we'll be back next week. Thank you guys so much.